it's basically about the business of writing, and they tell you the stuff they wish that someone had told them when they got started as writers.
You know, somebody can be a successful marketer and not necessarily provide a quality product.
I'm going to let Moses go because he's frothing at the mouth to talk about this one.
I like writing. I like reading. I like to immerse myself in books. So that seems like a pretty good career choice.
Domo arigato, Mr. Roboto.
Oh, you sound terrible. What happened? I'm just kidding.
Oh, man.
And now, podstructed on a Zeppelin by an apprentice mage and delivered by rocket ship to a benevolent dragon, Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing.
This is Moses Sirigar with Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, and I'm on the line with Mark Teppo. How are you doing tonight, Mark?
I'm well. How are you doing?
Doing really good. And we tried to do this last year at World Fantasy, right?
We did, yes.
Yeah, okay. It seemed like it was maybe longer than that, but you've got so much cool stuff going on that I'm sure it'll be a lot of fun to talk about all that good stuff, so...
See, and last year what it was is I was dodging because I didn't have any cool stuff going on.
I was thinking it probably works out really well, you know.
Worked out, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, like just today you had a Sinner release today, right?
Tuesday.
Yesterday?
Yes.
Yesterday, okay, yesterday. Sorry.
Yeah.
Right, the 28th, so congrats on that.
Thank you.
That's a prequel to the Mongoliad books, right?
It is, yeah. It's a short little novella that takes place about 6 or 7 years before the main Mongoliad, and is sort of an adventure with two of the characters who don't get a chance to meet in the Mongoliad, sort of having an adventure.
Oh, cool. Okay.
Setting the stage for things to come.
Oh, right, right. I was wondering, because I was looking at it today, and it's in like a Germanic setting, right? It's in Germany, or?
Yeah, it's right outside of, Marburg in Germany, okay. And goes, follows a sort of an inquisitor comes to town, Conrad von Marburg. And this little community has a problem with a witch, as you do, and things go awry, and the Inquisitor would like to sort of, you know, toe the party line, and Andreas and Raphael, the two characters, sort of get a feeling that not everything is as it is, and poke around a bit and cover a different story entirely, so...
Huh. These are some of the characters that become some of the sort of heroes in the Mongoliad books?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah, I was wondering how that tied in, but it makes sense because the characters come from like European areas, right? The major characters in the Mongoliad?
Right. So part of the fun with this one and some of the other shorts that we're doing is really sort of layering them into existing history.
Mm-hmm.
Conrad von Marburg was an inquisitor of this time period, who was sort of known for his zeal.
Okay.
And he has an accident on the road, like 6 months after this. And the truth and the what happened is never revealed. And so there was a little bit of that. And Elizabeth of Thuringia, who is a backstory character, was also an existing, interesting personality in this time period. So it's been sort of fun to go back and do the research and find ways to weave things together.
Hmm.
And sort of play with existing holes by putting our people in them.
That must be fun. So since we're talking about the Mongoliad, the second book comes out in September, end of September.
Yes.
Cool.
Yes.
And then I saw the third one, I believe, was it coming out early next year?
Yeah, in February.
Okay.
And then, starting this month, we start having a novella every month.
Oh, wow.
Running through the release of the fifth book, which will be February of 2014.
Wow. Okay. So it's five books in the, I didn't realize that. Was that the plan all along to have five?
Well, so the Mongoliad itself is... The Mongoliad, and this is where it starts getting sort of confusing. The Mongoliad is a single volume broken up into three books.
Okay, that sounds like what I thought.
And then there are two other books that are part of the medieval era of Foreworld. that are following, coming out afterward, which are new material, and not part of the existing three volume thing that had been serialized earlier. And then all the singles, or the side quests as we're calling them, are going to also be new as well. So yeah, there's a huge wealth of material that's sort of starting to drop.
Wow. And who's writing the novellas?
So we'll have some of the existing team, and then we'll also be bringing in some new people. In the short term, it's going to be myself and a couple other people on the team. Some people that have been sort of floating around to the periphery and been helping out. We'll be sort of stepping up. We'll be stepping up and doing some of the writing and helping out there while the rest of the team works on books 4 and 5. And then, so the plan is the novellas that sort of drop between now and book 3 are all going to be prequel-esque.
Mm-hmm.
Deal with sort of backstories of some of the characters and all that. And then after book 3, they'll start covering other time periods within Foreworld, which is this huge span of time from 400 BC to 1914. And then so since some of those will be essentially jump-starting different eras, that's when we'll have different writers coming in. So because there's a huge amount of material that you sort of have to get caught up on to play in the medieval world right now.
Wow.
And so this makes it a little bit easier to bring on some new people and sort of give them their own time period and their own little area to go play with and see what happens.
Okay. So that's kind of brave of you guys. You know, like you said, it's one big story that you're, you know, releasing in 3 parts. Because I noticed, like, some of the reviewers have said, you know, they expected maybe more of an ending from the books, right? But so it's kind of a brave move that, you know, that you did it that way. What do you think about how it's working out as far as that goes? I noticed that the book seems to sell well on Amazon. I noticed it's always near the top of the best-selling list. So, you know, congratulations to you guys. And, but yeah, what do you think about the way, you know, the way it's been received so far? Cause it's a pretty big deal, the whole Mongoliad thing.
Yeah. I mean, it was tough because the thing was initially put out as a 58 part serial with equally cliffhangers.
Wow.
So when you get right down to it, there's no good place. There really wasn't.
Okay.
And so it was sort of like, where can I break it in a way that makes people the least angry with me? And the choice to break it where I did at the end of the first book was because what happens next is that the hunting party, who you're following fairly closely, essentially go off into this long stretch of time where they're riding across the steppes, right? And nothing happens. They're riding for months at a time.
Mm.
And so in the narrative, the next time you catch up with them is like a month and a half later. And so in a very sort of mean way, I wanted the readers to have to wait that month and a half before they checked in with them again. So that it sort of mirrored the same sort of feeling that was time is passing and you know, these guys are writing day after day after day after day and there's not really much happening.
Hmm.
Time is passing. And so in that sense that there's a move in time from mid late June to September between book 1 and book 2. And so that to me was like, okay, we're gonna kinda sort of do that in real time as well.
Hmm.
And see how that works.
Right.
Because it's one of the things that after book 2 comes out, the fact that book 1 is a horrible cliffhanger is irrelevant.
Right.
Right. And after book 3 comes out, it's nobody complains about the Lord of the Rings being a cliffhanger.
Right.
But it was. And I went back and looked recently and sure, Frodo and Sam got in the boat and rode off, but nobody knew where they were and they were all going off. The rest of the team was off going off in the woods looking for what had happened to them, and that's the end. That's not the way. I mean, Tolkien wrote it as a single volume, but you know that was a cliffhanger of the worst sort. Nobody talks about it now that way. It's you know, and even the film, you know, recycles, repositions things in such a way that you know Boromir's death and all that sort of is the climactic moment of that first film. But that happens in the first or second chapter of book two.
Hmm.
When you look at it. So, I mean, it's one of those things where I can go like, you know, Tolkien did it, or Tolkien got, you know, Tolkien had to live with it too, so it's okay.
So is it the kind of thing now where you just say, well, I'm just going to take some lumps until book three is out, and then no one's really going to complain about it?
Because, I mean, the problem was that there were, every chapter was set up to be a cliffhanger.
Mm.
And there were worse places to do it. You know, like I sort of walked you through. I mean, this way at least I can sort of have a vague sense of this is why I did it. Well, then not anybody buys it. At least this is, you know, I can sleep better at night.
And for people who don't know, the same people contributed to the second book as the first one, right?
Yes. So it's the same team through all three.
So we've got Neal Stephenson, Eric Baer. We've got Joseph Brassey, Nicole Galland, Cooper Moo,
yep.
Mark Teppo, and Greg Baer?
Yep.
Okay. I just noticed that Amazon has him as Baer Greg at one point.
They do.
Okay. That's funny.
Well, we call him Papa Baer, too, so, you know, I think it's all.
So that's amazing. You know, you pulled off, I saw that one of your main jobs with, how do you say the company? It looks like Subutai. Earlier this year, I was playing in a 4th edition D&D campaign with a character named Subutai. He was a drow hunter, archer type from the Essentials 4th edition stuff, and he was pretty overpowered. He just took everything out. But I saw that. I was like, oh, Subutai.
Yep.
But I saw that one of your jobs is that you're the head cat herder of this sort of thing. And apparently you do this on multiple levels because you're herding the cats of a book, well, all these books, the Mongoliad books, and then you're involved with other projects too that we can talk about, like this amazing sounding video game project, Clang, that you're creating through this company. So Subutai is this company that you're involved with, and you're doing all sorts of interesting things there. Like the Mongoliad books are part of something that's under Subutai, and then Clang, this video game that you guys did a Kickstarter for, you raised over $500,000. For a game that's going to be a sword fighting game that, you know, people actually move and not just, you know, hold a little controller, but they're actually going to be moving and sort of sword fighting as they do it. So sort of like hardcore Wii sword fighting or something. I don't know what it would be, but it's amazing. The video for that was awesome. Oh my God, man. People should totally check out just the Kickstarter video, if they've not seen that video for the video game. I was blown away. That was an amazing video.
A lot of the credit in that video should really go to Brady Hall, who is the director.
Okay.
So Neal and I wrote the script, and of course, like anything that writers get their hands on, it was a lot longer and had narrative and all that sort of stuff. And Brady came in and very adroitly sussed out, you know, a lot of what was really useful and really good about it. And so much of his process was, we shot most of it in over 2 days. And both times we were in and done in a regular sort of working day sort of time period. Yeah, Brady was just phenomenal in getting in, herding way more cats than anyone should ever have to herd. And
wow.
Getting content that, you know, we could then go over again and again and again for the next 6 weeks and finally come up with, you know, that dazzling bit of video work. But yeah, a lot of the credit should go to Brady for persevering and finding the nut.
Wow.
All that.
If people want to find it, if we don't link to it on our show notes, just do a Google search for Kickstarter Clang, or actually go to even your website, go to marktepo.com, and you'll find the Kickstarter link right there on the homepage. Real easy to find it there.
Right, and it's also right off the Subutai homepage as well, which is subutai.mn.
subutai.mn. What does the MN stand for? Never seen that.
Mongolia.
Mongolia?
Yeah.
No kidding.
Yep.
Was that just sort of tongue-in-cheek, or?
It seemed that if we were going to have a company named after Genghis Khan and Ogadai Khan's greatest general, we should, you know, have it be a sort of a appropriate domain.
Oh, interesting.
Well, so
Subutai was a general under Genghis Khan.
Yes, he was the man sort of responsible for the the empire expanding as much as it did. I mean, Genghis had a vision, and sort of showed up and said, here's my vision, make it happen. And Subutai was the guy who actually went out and made it happen. Story has it, he was so enormous that it took 3 horses to carry him.
Wow.
Which is kind of a trick for a culture which prides itself on being highly mobile and highly adaptive, that, you know, this guy who needed 3 horses to get around was tolerated.
Would he, like, ride one horse for a while and then the horse would take a break and get on the next one, or?
You know, I'm sure it's all completely hyperbolic.
Okay.
But yeah, that's probably how it had to have worked. I can't imagine him sort of spread across 3 horses. What you're supposed to think is that he was just so large that, you know, he spread himself across 3 horses, straddled all 3, you know. They're Mongol ponies, so, you know, they're not
right.
Not huge draft horses, but, you know, it's probably just part of the myth.
Huh. Well, that's neat. Let's see. So people can check that out. And so you're ahead of this, and go ahead.
So a lot of all this is Subutai is in the business of making franchises, is what it really comes down to. And our argument is that, you know, in this day and age, the technology and the creative flexibility and the whole concept of highly agile teams is such that, you know, you can make a franchise that spans multiple media types in a way that plays well with each media type. And so that's sort of our long range plan.
Okay.
You know, it's not entirely accidental that there is a Circus of Swords in the Mongoliad. Because eventually, you know, we're hoping to have a video game which involves people fighting with swords. Right. And so it's that sort of long range sort of planning and thinking, and you know, eventually there will, and eventually after, you know, we get the fundamentals, mechanics of fighting down, there's going to be some sort of MMO RPG style game, right? Which will be its own thing.
Wow.
Which won't follow the Mongoliad because, you know, there's, you know, 50 characters in Mongoliad, right? How are you going to do, you know, how are you going to do a single person sort of adventure when you've got that many characters? So you need to write something that is appropriate for that sort of framework.
Wow.
You know, and then, oh, look, we should probably do a movie, you know, that's going to look like something else, right? You can't distill 500,000 words into a 2-hour movie. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a miniseries at best. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's that sort of approach to things is sort of looking at the time frames and looking at the various sorts of aspects of story and say, okay, here's the arc. You know, we get them reading the books now. They follow these characters. They follow this time period. You know, when we're done with that, we've got this other media type that's coming out. It dovetails nicely, you know, and it takes them through this adventure, which is, you know, a movie or a video game or a TV series or, you know, or a miniseries or whatever. But that takes them to, you know, this new point, at which point then what do we have? Well, maybe more novels, maybe comic books. But, you know, you've got this sort of rolling sort of content flow that speaks well to whatever media type it is, right?
Wow, that's brilliant. I see that. I was going to ask you how this works. Neil Stephenson is listed as the chairman. Mm-hmm. You are listed as the CEO and chief creative officer.
Right.
So how does that work in terms of what does that look like?
I'm in charge of the day-to-day and Neil's in charge of the big ideas.
Okay.
So yeah, and he likes the big ideas and he likes thinking about the big ideas, and it's good to have him thinking about the big ideas, but, you know, checking the mailbox and paying the bills and those sorts of things are you know, good for me to do. And I you know, as part of my job with the cat herding and working with the writers is that I have a good head for keeping track of all the details and spinning things and putting things together in sort of a quick, facile way. That, you know, I can then sort of put in front of him. He thinks about, puts a different spin on them. We iterate. So, you know, it works.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you've got on your team here, you've got Karen Lohr, as vice president, and Greg Baer as a senior advisor.
Yes. Yeah. So Karen's in charge of video game development. She's, like, Clang is her baby in many ways.
How is Clang coming along?
Good. Now we've gotten through the all the email from the Kickstarter. We've got a team almost put together, and they're going to be getting started here next week, in fact. So it'll be, by the time this airs, they'll have been underway for some time.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Neat. Yeah.
And then we'll start, details will start emerging as they start getting things
done. And how did you guys end up going with 47 North for the books?
They came along, we were about a half a year into the serial version. And I think they came along and they got it. That's just really sort of how it turned out. They showed up and we gave them the pitch. I spent a half hour drawing the long-term plan on the board with all the different sorts of things. And they looked at us and said, okay, how can we help?
So you met with them in Seattle and kind of pitched it to them. And
yeah, and they've been lovely. So, fantastic.
Okay. Are they open about who is, the head editors and such, like the key people in 47 North? 47 North is sort of an imprint, is that right? Science fiction, fantasy, horror imprint from Amazon.
From Amazon, yes.
Okay.
And it's pretty much all run by people in the industry.
Okay.
There's a number of individuals who have, years of experience in New York publishing who are doing this. And so that's been really lovely, is that it's not just been, a bunch of people who've never done anything in publishing. It's people who got years of experience. And so it's been very easy to work with them and very lovely to work with them. And there's a wealth of sort of knowing how things work that's been available. So. Yeah.
Okay. Is it public knowledge who these people are, or is it all very secretive?
I honestly don't know.
Okay.
I assume that's their sort of news to share.
Huh. Most of the time you have an imprint, it's public knowledge who's the editor and who's the this and that, but I just don't know if that's out there or not. I'm just looking on their Amazon page here, and I don't necessarily see it, but... Interesting. What is it like, being with them? Like do they have their books in, like, say, Barnes & Noble stores and things like that? Or, because I remember there was some issue at one point of, like, Barnes & Noble not wanting to carry the Amazon imprints. Did that ever get worked out?
As far as I know, that's still being worked out. It's the saber rattling at corporate level.
You're right.
And any author in any book in experience has got some sort of, hill to climb, hole to get out of, whatever, barrier to cross. Amazon and Barnes & Noble are sorting out some differences as far as who is going to carry what. And the last I heard that Barnes & Noble was not carrying print volumes in the stores. You could order them, of course, but you couldn't actually get them in the stores. It's a shame.
Right.
But, independent bookstores are carrying it. I mean, here in Seattle, there's a number of independent bookstores which carry it, which is great. I've seen it at other independent bookstores across the country. So, personally, making it harder for people to buy books seems sort of silly at this point.
Mm-hmm.
I think most consumers don't care about the saber rattling. They just don't understand why they can't get what they came in the store to get. If they hear, we're in the middle of having a staring match with Amazon, all the customers are going to hear is Amazon, and that's what they're going to do. They're going to leave and go home and order from Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
And Barnes & Noble just lost the sale entirely, and so I don't,
right.
I don't quite see how that's effective. But I get that there's a certain amount of, we have to make a stand somewhere on certain areas, and that's how things go. So
yeah.
I don't think about it too much. I try not to worry about it too much, and I'm always happy to see it in independent bookstores.
Huh. So does 47 North, just because I don't know, I have to ask, do they focus more on ebooks then, or are they still very interested in, trying to get the books in as many stores as possible, or do they have a certain focus like that?
I have no idea. I know that I've been instructed to send any independent bookstore that wants to carry it to them, and they'll happily make it happen, which seems to be the case. So,
okay. So the books are largely mostly in independent bookstores at this point.
Yeah, which is great. It's just one of those things where, back in the day, Barnes & Noble rolled in and sort of gave independent bookstores the scare, and some of them went out of business. And, now Amazon's sort of putting the same squeeze on Barnes & Noble. And it's a whole level of behemoth sort of battling it out. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like watching a Godzilla movie, you know? Godzilla's in town and Mothra shows up and they sort of wreck Tokyo and everybody in the streets like trying to get noodles or, you know, a beverage. Just this little thing where you're like, I hope I can make it across the street kind of a thing. You know, without getting stomped on by Godzilla. You know, I think a lot of it's that sort of completely different world from the day-to-day sort of trying to figure out how to get noodles or across the street or whatever.
This episode is brought to you by the new science fiction novel Wolf Dawn by Susan Cartwright. Ashton Chayton was born with a powerful gift, a unique inhuman ability. Orphaned, raised by the Red Wolves of Open, captured and enslaved, he is now free and on the run. Unfortunately, everybody wants Ashton. Admiral Jones will torture him to get the secret of his power. Lady Linda feels he is the one, as named in Temple prophecy. The influential Lord Andros just wants him dead. Ashton only wants two things, revenge and the Lady Linda. If you had unique powers, wouldn't you use them to get what you want? Wolf Dawn is one of the first titles from Hotspur Publishing, and it is a title not afraid to explore material some would call controversial. That said, this is a fast-paced adventure novel that will keep you turning pages, and publisher David Bischoff says it is written in the vein of Dune and Ender's Game. Come to our website and click on the image for Wolf Dawn to learn more, or go to SusanCartwright.com to learn more about the author and the novel. Wolf Dawn, new science fiction by Susan Cartwright.
Lots of cool stuff, you know, I still want to keep talking to you about, but I want to also make sure to get some things in before we go too far into tangents. I want to ask you also about your Earth Thirst novel that's coming out through Nightshade Books, right?
Nightshade's doing that one, yes.
In January of next year, 2013. The cover for Earth Thirst, you've got to be so thrilled with that cover, man.
I am very thrilled with that.
The cover is awesome.
Yeah, that's done by Cody Tilson, who did the design for Rob Ziegler's Seed last year, and for Katie Stauber's Revolution World. He also did that one for Nightshade, and then John Joseph Adams' Brave New World. I think he did as well. But he's done a couple books with them, and so when Nightshade said, you know, we're gonna have Cody do the cover, I was suitably thrilled, and more so when it's, you know, it showed up. And he's done some refinements. I saw the art a while ago, but he's now gone through and done the actual, you know, put it all together for the design. And, yeah, the title alone, I think is really awesome. He just sort of brought it all together.
Whose idea was the title?
That was not my title. I will be right up front and admit that one. That is totally editorial handed down from on high. I had a different title, which I am embarrassed enough now by, I'm not going to say.
Come on.
Oh, it was totally the wrong sort of message. I mean, Nightshade did the Codex books, the first two Codex of Souls books, Lightbreaker and Heartland, a couple years ago. And it was, Jason Williams and I have talked about this. It was a bumpy ride. It wasn't exactly the most well presented material in the sense of getting it on the shelves. And, you know, he sort of laughed at me the other day. He's like, gosh, you know, we sort of, you know, dropped the ball on that one, but it's still selling. So I you know, something must be right. And I'm like, maybe it's the writing, I had this sort of standing offer to come back and do something else with them. And I've been sort of, you know, kind of like, well, let's see what happens. And, I saw their new line of trade paperbacks at, World Fantasy last year in San Diego. Rob Ziegler's book was one of them, and the whole new sort of new voices and the new look and everything. And it was really sort of exciting and talking with them and seeing that they sort of had this refocus and sort of dedication to pitching the books and selling the books like they used to before things got sort of complicated and fraught with all sorts of, you know, financial issues. And the book, I had the idea for the book for a couple of years now. I've been sort of deciding on what to do about it and sort of don't really have time to do it right and so on and so forth. But after World Fantasy, I was like, these guys get it. I mean, I know that it won't take me very long to get them behind this book and get them to understand what I want to do with this book. And because once they get their teeth in something, they really know how to what to do with it. I mean, and I really felt that that's the sort of thing that this book needed was a team that really got it. And so I sent it off and I told Jeremy last night, I said, I don't have time to write this right now, but I'm sort of sick of it sitting on my desk. And, you know, in 2 years from now, when I get around to it, it's still going to be sick of it sitting on my desk. But so, you know, the only way it's going to happen is if you want it and insist that I write it and force it on my schedule. Which of course he totally did, which is, you know, the right thing to do. And it took them several months before they got back to me and said, okay, we're changing the title. I'm like, okay. And then they explained to me Earth Thirst. And the first time I thought, yeah, that's a dumb title. I don't like that title. And then we talked about some more, and I realized that it had come out of a several hour sort of meeting in the office of them all sitting around going, okay, what are we going to do with this book? How's it going to work? How are we going to market it? How are we going to sell it? And sort of all sort of getting behind it and understanding what it was and what it meant and what I was trying to accomplish with it and what they thought it should be. And that's where the title came from. And the more I thought about it, I'm like, that is an absolutely perfect title. Mm-hmm. Absolutely great title. And it also just really demonstrated to me that they got it. And they knew sort of where it was going to go.
Because there's an element of, is it eco-terrorism? Or what is it, eco? What goes after the eco here?
I've been saying eco-thriller.
Eco-thriller, okay. Yeah. And there's also a vampire element in the story.
Yes.
So there's the earth and the thirst. And then on the cover, it's, you know, it's surrounded by red, so you get some blood imagery, perhaps.
Right.
It's a smart title.
Yeah, no, and after a while, I mean, I had trouble saying it for a while because I kept thinking of Earth First.
Right.
But which is, of course, exactly what they want you to think. It's all but yeah, after a while, I was like, yeah, I know, it totally works, and it makes the other title really dumb, so, you know, I didn't.
I'm trying to read the Sherry Priest quote on the cover. I've got the enlarged version of it here. Let's see if I can do this. Grim and refined, Teppo's aggressive something noir. What is that? Something noir is rich and strange, heavily and deftly textured. It's got a punch that'll leave you rattled, intrigued, and
wanting more.
Tasting blood? What does it say? Tarting blood? I can't read it. But anyway, it's
tasting blood. Rattled and
tasting blood, okay.
Tasting blood. There we go.
What was the noir part that I missed? Grim and refined, Teppo's aggressive.
Near noir is near
noir.
Strange, heavily and deftly textured. It's got a punch that'll leave you rattled, intrigued, and tasting blood.
There you go. Cool. Brilliant. As far as what's going on with Nightshade, I mean, we have a mutual friend, Jonathan Wood. So he was one of the authors who was with Nightshade, and then I don't know how many authors were in the situation where they were in the middle of a series and Nightshade had to drop the books mid-series, that they had something going on this summer or something like that, right? Can you explain what was going on at all?
I haven't heard. You know, okay. I haven't had to actually, Jonathan and I are pals as well, and I honestly have not had a chance to catch up with him and shake him down for
comfort.
I do know that, is it Yesterday's Hero? It did come out. I think he self-published it.
Yep. Yeah. They gave him the rights back. We actually had him on the podcast when he released No Hero, right? The first book.
Right.
And so they gave him. You know, I think it was planning on bringing it out and everything, and then they gave him the rights back for it. So he self-published it. And but I think there were other authors caught up in this recently at Nightshade too. I don't know, all the scoop on that, but. So, you know, whatever happened, it seemed like maybe they had downsized it in some way, but they're still doing your thing, which is great. And there's another Codex book too, right?
There's a gentleman on Facebook who pings me every 6 months or so whenever I mention Angel Tongue and reminds me that he's still waiting. and one of the lovely things about Facebook is that, you know, no message is ever not connected to the previous messages. So I'm able to see like this 2.5 year conversation of me saying, yeah, I'm working on it next, you know, it goes back forever. And I finally just went, dude, I'm sorry. I am stringing you on in the worst sort of way, but really it's on my plate at some point. But other things keep coming up.
Okay. So there's not an impending release in that series then.
No,
okay.
No, it was set up to be a series of duologies. And so that, you know, if nothing else happens after Heartland, then I feel like I've sort of wrapped up things well enough that that's okay.
Right.
But there is definitely, I think I pitched like 10 volumes once upon a time. So there are plans, but it's just sort of timing. And then, of course, after a couple of years, you sort of have to reconsider how you're going to restart a series in a way that a bookstore will care, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you say it's the third book, then they look at how the first two sold and make a decision there, and that's never very good.
Mm.
You know, and so do you relaunch it? Do you not number them? You know,
right?
Those sorts of things are sort of rattling around your head, and that sort of question is okay. So if we relaunch it with Angel Tongue, then you know, do I not reference the other two? Are they, you know, are they sort of, oh, if you're interested, they here they are, but they're not required. You know, there's lots of those sort of questions that have to be sort of thought about. And because I always do things wrong, I wrote them a long outline based on the idea that you would not have to know anything about Lightbreaker and Heartland in order to enjoy Angel Tongue. And then immediately proceeded to make the ending sort of completely hinge on having read Lightbreaker. So we'll see how that turns out.
Wow. And, I mean, as far as that series goes, it's really fascinating. I was actually checking it out, and it looks incredibly cool to me, because you're doing something that is sort of like an urban fantasy, but you kind of wanted to write it without the vampires, lycanthropes, zombies, angels, demons, and there's more of an emphasis on magic and esoterica and arcane subjects and things like that. Is that right?
Yep. Yeah, as long as it was. And I mean, this is also sort of what happened with Earththirst too, which is that a lot of that sort of those basic tropes, I can't figure out how to wrap my head around them. You know, and that's why it took me years to figure out how to write a vampire novel, because I just didn't understand how it worked.
Mm-hmm.
It's you know, 19th century urban mythology,
right?
Which has no relevance. And so how do you? I couldn't do the world building. Lightbreaker and Heartland were initially very much in those. They were, Markham was both a vampire and a werewolf in the original version. because, you know, why not throw everything in the mix? When I had a chance to sort of do a rewrite of it and think about it, I was like, that's not the story I want to tell. I felt there's a whole rich heritage of esoterica and a culture that really is what urban fantasy should be about, frankly, that isn't tapped.
Right.
And isn't there. And, you know, sure, I studied mythology in college, and that informed my decision slightly as well, but I thought it had much more relevance to a modern audience than sort of waving my hands and saying, you know, vampires and stakes and, you know, crosses and all sunlight and all that stuff. And silver bullets for werewolves and that sort of thing. And so that's where it went, and it was a lot of fun. I totally dug them in, and I had a ball, and I've actually been talking with the guy doing the audiobook this week. Audible is putting out an audio version, and nice. So Andy Kaplow is doing the reading, and so he and I've been talking all week, and it's been a lot of fun to sort of get back into them and talk about them, especially from an audio presentation sense of some of the subtleties of the mythology and of the world building and everything that went on that he's, you know, going to try to sort of capture by in his reading. And so that's been a real hoop to sort of revisit all that and talk about what I was trying to accomplish. So there's an Amazon review. Some poor guy hammered me for the fact that his action thriller turned into a gospel out of the Gnostic texts, which is wanted, and was very disappointed and frankly said, I'm never going to read anything that Mark has ever written ever again.
Oh.
And I was like, dude, I got you. That's kind of what I wanted to hit you with by the end. So I have to sort of say, you know, I did my job. Sorry, but I'm okay with this.
More than a century ago, UEP Captain Julius Burndock helped end a galactic war with the Majesty, the first truly living machine, thanks to man-made artificial intelligence. For decades, Majesty and humanity had lived together in harmony, with mankind reaping the benefit of a world free of disease, famine, and even aging. But when Majesty decided she wanted to birth her own AI offspring, a joint interplanetary military effort fought and finally defeated her, and then eradicated all existing artificial intelligence. Or so they thought. Inspired at an early age by the works of Jack Chalker and Timothy Zahn, author A.J. Vega gives us Majesty's Offspring, a new science fiction novel bursting with action, and suspense on a truly galactic scale. To learn more, visit our website, adventuresinscifipublishing.com, and click on the image for Majesty's Offspring, or visit majestiesoffspring.com. And as of the time of this recording, Majesty's Offspring is free for both Kindle and Nook. That's right, free for a limited time. So what are you waiting for? Majesty's Offspring, new science fiction from A.J. Vega.
Speaking of the esoterica, you mentioned on your Subutai bio, so you conclude by saying he's also the kind of guy who has a favorite tarot card. So
yes.
What is your favorite tarot card?
The Moon.
The Moon. I was going to guess the Fool, because you had a little thing about the Fool card in the Aleister Crowley Thoth deck on one of your pages, too.
Yes. No, the Fool is a great card, but I love the Moon, and a lot of the reason I love the Moon is because of what Crowley says about it in the Book of Thoth. See, I don't get many opportunities to turn around and grab this off the shelf, because I have it right there.
I'm looking up the image right now, just because I forget what that one looks like.
So this is, he talks about, one is reminded of the mental echo of subconscious realization of that supreme iniquity which mystics have constantly celebrated in their accounts of the dark night of the soul. But the best men, the true men, do not consider the matter in such terms at all. Whatever horrors may afflict the soul, whatever abominations may excite the loathing of the heart, whatever terrors may assail the mind, the answer is the same at every stage. How splendid is the adventure. That to me is, the Moon is that threshold where it's, and Nietzsche, Crowley even talks about it, says the threshold of life, the threshold of death, that moment between, here and there, being in nothingness when everything is possible. I'm just laughing because there's a song my kids have been listening to in the car by a band called Ego Likeness that is called Everything is Poison. And the chorus is, everything is poison, nothing is poison, which the kids have a lovely time singing at the top of their lungs in my car. And I'm
Earlier today, I sent you a Facebook message, and I said, just real quick, do you have anything in mind you might want to talk about? And I was surprised that the first thought out of your brain was indie publishing. So because you're going through 47 North, you're going through Nightshade Books, you're running this really interesting creative company too. But what are your thoughts on the indie publishing thing?
Well, I thought maybe you'd had some thoughts on it.
Okay, all right. I just thought, what's Mark doing with that?
I'm thinking about it. I'm thinking about it quite a lot. I've been talking about it with people off and on, and I think it's a really interesting time to be a writer. I mean, I've been doing a lot of reading contracts and paying attention and sort of listening to things about the industry, and it's sort of what we run into a lot when we're trying to do deals and talk business, which is that the traditional view of the artist has been, well, not very good view, right? That we'll happily give up everything in return for a pittance. It was true back in the old days, but it's less true now. And I think that the tools are available, and I think that the way our audiences are approaching content is opening up a lot of opportunities for people to sort of make their own destiny. Don't get me wrong, it's a lot of work. It's an inordinate amount of work. But if you're in this for the long haul, it's work you own. The sort of thought experiment I've been weighing a lot recently is, I get that first book advance, that monumentally exciting $5,000 first book advance, 2 years till the book comes out, and nobody may care when the book comes out. There may be no marketing, but the book is out. Okay, in 2 years, I'll be a much better writer, and that'll be the first thing people see. Okay, well, it's just my career. My audience is always going to be 2 years behind my career, right? Versus, okay, what if I took that book and did something with it now and kept writing? Would I make $5K in 2 years selling it myself? Maybe, maybe not. But it's a lot of work. But I would own that audience, right?
Right.
Those will be my people. They will. I will be able to communicate with them. I will be able to sell other things to them. That becomes my pipeline. And so I write. Clearly, I'm going to write another book. It's you're building this pipeline yourself versus it being dependent upon the luck of the draw or whatever. From the other end. And that's sort of the puzzle that I'm sort of trying to get some data on and sort of wrap my head around is, if in if a traditional publishing career is you do 3 to 5 books at sort of rock bottom numbers and then you move up, that's 5 to 7 to 10 years versus you doing 3 to 5 books in 5 years and being able to go to New York and say, hey, I've got those 5K numbers already. You need to put a little something more on the table. It's, you know, you sort of pushing your career further along on your own, and you own that pipeline. You own that audience. Not own them, but you have a relationship with them. Chris Randall, who used to front Sister Machine Gun, has been sort of doing his own thing musically for a couple decade and a half now, 2 decades? Anyway, a while now. But recently on his blog, which is over at analogindustries.com, posted a sort of not a mission statement, not a memo, not certainly not a manifesto, talking about the idea of the reputation garden and sort of where, in many ways, it's sort of what the music industry is sort of facing, having gone through the sort of meltdown that I think publishing is on the cusp of. And his point was, you know, there really are two hats. You know, there's the artist hat who makes stuff because they can, and then there's the selling hat which goes out and does something with it. And you can't get too wound up and you can't wear the wrong hat at the wrong time.
Mm-hmm.
And the selling hat, is their job is to tend the reputation garden. You know, is to build that sort of garden of content and of excellence that people will show up for. That people will say, yeah, I'll give you money for you to do something. And it's, like you said, it's not a mission statement and it's not a manifesto. It's more just a you can't get tied up in worrying about all the minutiae of selling the work, when really it comes down to it's a relationship that you're going to have with an audience that is entirely out of your control. But fundamentally, people get it. People would rather pay for things that have value than not. And there's a certain amount of education that needs to go on. But, you know, you have to be doing it for the reason, you have to be doing it for the right reasons and in the right way, and not be spending all your time worrying about things that you really don't have any control over. Anyway, and people should go read the non-memo, because he says it much better than I am now. But I think it really is part of that sort of fundamental, the fundamental sort of guiding sort of thought that you gotta put your butt in the chair and do the work. And it's not that the rest will sort itself out, but there's a certain amount of it will never be fair. It will never be, you know, it will never be, or someone will always get a better break than you, and so on and so forth. But I think all that aside, there comes a level where it starts flowing back. It has to. Otherwise, it has to.
So how would people look up that?
So it's analogindustries.com, and it's a couple weeks ago now, I think it's. Anyway, the title of the post was It's Not a Memo, or It's a Memo, or something to that effect.
It's not a memo, yeah. That's cool. Actually, I'm just coming up on 5,000 copies sold of my novel in about 13 months, and, you know, starting to maybe have some traction like that.
Right.
And it's an interesting place, because I actually have a well-known, you know, science fiction fantasy publisher who is looking at the book right now, and they were interested because I went to them and said, you know, I've sold this number of books. Earlier this month, it was 4,000. I said, it's been a year. Book's been out a year. I sold 4,000. This month has like been my best month ever. I'm coming up on 1,000 sales this month. Yeah. And it's like, and now I'm at the point where I have enough to interest a publisher maybe.
Right.
And at the same time, it's kind of like, well, I'm also starting to maybe be able to do something really cool on my own. And it's, you know, it's always been a hard choice for me to figure out what to do with that from the beginning.
Right.
And it still is, you know, and I very much would like to be with a publisher in a lot of ways, and yet I can see that I like, you know, the direction that I'm going independently too. So I don't know, that just speaks a little bit to what you were talking about, where it's lots of pros and cons.
Right. I mean, and you get what you pay for. I mean, you really do. I mean, I'm certainly not advocating that you should write the book and put it up there and fairy dust will magically appear on it and things will happen. No, I mean, it still needs to be a good book. It still has to have a decent cover. It still has to be edited. There's still some marketing that needs to be done. The thing about a traditional publisher is that they do all those things for you, right?
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, they take a piece of the pie.
Yeah.
It may be more of a piece of pie than you would like, but that's the piece of pie they take. By being an independent publisher, you get to decide how much of that pie you want to spend on those things. That becomes part of the equation, and that becomes part of I am certainly not one to armchair publish here, as far as you know, big publishing goes. But you know, it seems to me that more and more first novels and early novels, the onus of marketing is falling on the writer. And so, what are you getting? Editorial, okay. Cover, okay. Those things all have very valid costs, and you're getting bookstore distribution. I mean, there's lots of things you're getting, but a lot of what makes a book sell, beyond it being just an awesome piece of literature, which every single one of our books are, is marketing, word of mouth, you know? And if more and more of that is falling on the author, then maybe the early part of our careers is spent doing that ourselves.
Yeah, I think that when you're independent, you know, you have to take responsibility for that. I think it's a really healthy thing, because, you know, you don't get sucked in a situation where you just sort of sit back and you expect the publisher to do all the marketing for you. I mean, obviously, I've had to do my own sort of marketing and stuff like that. And it makes you take ownership of it. And I think that's a good thing. And, you know, one of my biggest questions is always, you know, I don't quite understand the breakdown of how much money right now would you actually make from print distribution versus what you can do with ebooks. Because I tend to think I can sell ebooks better than publishers, because the big names, obviously, they're going to sell way more than you know, anyone like me. But you know, let's say that, you know, typical writer like me, you know, like right today, I mean, as luck would have it, today is the absolute best sales day I've ever had for my novel. I'm looking at my rank right now; it's number 254 in the Kindle store. And you know, and the publisher that I'm, you know, interested in, I've looked at their Kindle rankings and they're not as good as that, you know. And even my normal thing recently has been around like 10 or 11,000 in the Kindle store. My Kindle rankings are generally better than the books from that publisher, you know. And so I can probably sell ebooks better on my own. And I don't know how much, if I go with a publisher, how many physical books I'm gonna sell, you know, with a publisher. And that's part of the industry I don't know. I need to like ask people about, I guess. But that's a lot of what it comes down to. And then projecting forward, you know, well, how much more is of the market's going to be ebooks 1 year from now and 2 years from now, and how much less shelf space will there be for the physical books going forward? And obviously if the physical thing is drying up, you know, and the ebooks are growing, that's pretty much been the trend, right? Then it's really questionable. And then it comes back to like, well, then I probably want a good advance. You know, that's my insurance against maybe screwing up, you know. and then publishers may be less willing to give those because of the what's going on with the industry, right? So we're kind of at a crossroads with a lot of things. And like you said, the publishing industry may be changing quite a bit, like the music industry did. It certainly is changing, but that's what I get to try to figure out.
Right. And I think it's very much in flux. I mean, it's changing. And I think that, you know, mid-list authors are discovering that there is life for their backlist, right? That it, and it's not waiting around for the traditional publishing to look at. It's them taking off and doing it on their own. I think a lot of it comes down to the real reality is that for any one of us, it's not going to be one book that's going to make or break us. It's going to be a bulk of material.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You're never going to get paid unless it's astronomical sort of, you know, bestseller type numbers. You know, it's going to be a body of work over time that's going to generate revenue that's going to, you know, keep the lights on.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes back to butt in chair, work out there in a way that people can pay you for it. That's the thing I was going back to. Like, you know, it's 2 years before New York gets a book out. You know, that's three more novels I could write. What's the benefit there?
Yeah, the time delay is tough.
It becomes Stephen King back in the day did The Plant. You know, that was his experiment in digital publishing because he could, you know. I mean, he was interested and he was curious about it. And it didn't work, but, you know, he learned some things and he made some money and that was that. And, you know, I think, you know, those people at his level can certainly dabble, if you will. People like us who are still sort of trying to make our way in the world, these sorts of things are the return is smaller and the effort seems to be, you know, a larger mountain for a smaller bag of rocks kind of thing. You know, you spend any time reading Joe Conrath's blog, and the thing that comes through loud and clear is that he's putting out content. There was a Forbes list a couple weeks ago about the top 12 writers, you know, what they made last year. And the difference between number 12 and number 2 was probably $10 million.
Wow.
I mean, it went from like 5 million to, well, it was like from like 8 million to 22 million, something like that. And it was a relatively small amount for the fact that you had 11 people.
Hmm.
So the incremental change was $2 or $3 million per person, right? Stephen King was number two at $25 million, something like that. Number one was James Patterson, $84 million.
You said 84?
94 million.
94 million, okay.
So $70 million difference between number one and number two. How many books did Patterson put out last year? 13. He could have done six and probably made $50 million or whatever. But I mean, it's clear there that you know, volume is helping him.
Yeah.
Because, you know, how long does it take you to read a book? A couple days? If you're lucky, a week? People like, and that's the thing I don't think has changed. People like reading. I don't think ebooks are making people, I think ebooks are making it easier for people to read,
mm-hmm.
which in some ways I think is bringing reading back.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's definitely having a change on the used market, because you used to look at the romance barn back in the day, and the sign on the door would say, you know, fill the bag for $10. And you go in and there's constant churn. You know, people come in and every day filling their bag of books, and they come back next week and they fill their bag for, you know, $10. Why? They like to read. And I think that, you know, any sort of regular stream of content, when it finds a readership, they're happy to pay money. They really are. I mean, people don't go to used bookstores because they're trying to stick it to the authors. They're going to use bookstores because they like to read and they can't afford to be paying hardback prices every week or every month.
Mm-hmm.
They like to read, and that's why the libraries are still in business. And I fundamentally think that the more we as authors write, and this is for the most of us. I mean, you're going to have the people who are going to write one book and be done, and it's going to be, you know, Harper Lee, Kill a Mockingbird, that kind of success story. But for most of us, you know, it's a job. It's a day job. You know, it has its ups and downs. It has its crappy years. It has its good years. And you show up, butt in chair, you put things out. One of the stories that Lawrence Block talks about in one of his numerous writing books, which is, some years suck. Some years are better than others. You keep writing. He's got, how many books does he have? I don't know. Many.
This has been great. I want to just maybe ask you a personal question as we sign off. Now that you're doing the Subotai Corporation or whatnot, you know, how do you see yourself going forward? Do you still envision yourself primarily wanting to be a novelist, or is that changing? Or, you know, what's your kind of like your vision, and where do you see yourself going?
Like 8 months or so ago, John Klima and I had a chat. John and I go way back, and we were talking about the 5-year plan and the 10-year plan.
Mm.
You know, checking in. How's your 5-year plan? How's your 10-year plan going on?
Mm-hmm.
And I laughed and I said, none of what I'm doing was on either plan, and none of what I'm doing was ever even within scope of either plan. In many ways, it seems strange. I mean, I'm my calendar in many ways is I'm booked up through April of next year with stuff to do. And after that, there will be other things to do because things will come up between now and then. I think that's my job, which is not really to sort of, I know this is not really an answer, but I'm making things up every day. So this quarter, it's novellas, you know, next quarter will be a novel. There may be a screenplay in there somewhere. It's part of the fun of sort of making our own way in the world is figuring out where a writer fits in this 21st century world and what they can do to make a living and what they can do to be creative. You know, I think a lot of it falls in the category of saying yes to opportunities. I wrote a novelization of a aerialist troops retelling of ancient Hittite mythology earlier this year because they asked, and because I thought, sure, how many times do I get to say that that's what I got to do earlier this year? But you know, it was retelling myths that were being retold from a visual sort of presentation. And yeah, it was an interesting and creative way to do things. And it was fun.
It sounds like fun. Yeah.
So is
there something that you know, a project you have like really close to your heart, something that you would still like to do, that you haven't done? Is there anything really on your wish list like that?
The story I actually just had out in Beneath Ceaseless Skies last month is issue 101, called The Heart of the Rail, is a bit of world building on something I hope to get to at some point. I've been putting it off for years because I've been sort of worried about the research. And it was pointed out to me that after The Sinner and the novella next month, Dreamer, I really can't use that excuse anymore. Hmm. So I think that'll be something that's going to get worked on.
That's cool. What would that look like?
It's Tesla punk. And the trick has been sort of figuring out how the world is built around that phrase and how far down the rabbit hole I want to go. Yeah.
Cool.
We'll see.
Awesome. Awesome. It's been a lot of fun to talk to you, man. I'll finally let you go here. But, yeah, I've enjoyed it. And,
All right.
You know, I hope we can hang out at some cons in the future and keep it going. I've seen you at two World Fantasies now, so.
All right.
You're kind of.
No one coming up here in Toronto, so.
I know. I think I'm going to miss this one, but I think I want to make Brighton next year. Yeah, I've never been over to England, and I really want to head over there. That'll give me a good excuse to do it, so I'm saving up for that one, I think.
All right. I'm sure we'll run into each other again.
Okay. Thanks, man.
Please visit adventuresinscifipublishing.com for show notes, videos, reviews, and more, and email us at adventuresinscifipublishing@gmail.com. Some sound effects from the Free Sounds Project. Music by Asymmetry, found at musicalley.com. No authors were permanently damaged in the making of this podcast.